accession number 18041, Reel 2.
The maintenance problems and the ancillary equipment and such like, I think in the Viscount revolutionised civil utilisation by our standards. But Monty was talking about the engine and not knowing too much about it except for the certification problems. There was a little sideline to that, the certification apropos the engines, which I will never forget because it was a bit of test flying which I got a tremendous kick out of it. When we were trying to establish the drag on the aeroplane, we had a problem because there was about X pounds of residual thrust coming from the jet pipes, and Rolls-Royce could never give the technical people some formula to work out. We knew all about the propellers and the shaft horsepower, but there was a residual thrust coming out. How much was that? Because without knowing that, we could never find out what the airframe drag was. So the design office tried this, tried that, and did this, that, the next thing, and eventually we were pulled into a meeting. The GRE was chief designer then, and the only way to solve this was to fly the airplane with all the engines stopping. And when you first hear these little gems chipped in, your heart beats a little bit faster, and you think, now, wait a minute, can it be done? But when you get down with a lot of experts, who have presumably studied it all before they bring the flight test crew in, they had a deal going to up the battery life, or double the battery power, laid down some weather conditions, where it could be done, and strict rules that if you started off at 25,000, when the altimeter read 10,001 feet, no matter, Monty said, another 2 seconds. He said, hard luck, you had to start a relight program. And we finished up very satisfactory, in fact, with some gay abandon. We did from 100 knots right up to DD on the particular aeroplane. And I can well remember sitting there for many, many, it took us weeks to do this because you could only do one glide.
You said 100 knots up to what?
About 290 indicated.
Yes. Yeah. Design driving speed, VD.
Mm. Yeah. In increments of 10 knots or something. So it was one flight for 10 knots. So you presume there are 29 flights. But I put in my nickel's worth, I would not do it unless I could finish up over Boscombe Down at 10,000 feet with clear air. And it worked out something like about 5 or 6 miles per 1,000 feet. So we used to start these things as far afield as Cardiff. And we had the Bristol Channel with nothing going, knowing that we would finish up at Boscombe Down at 10,000 feet. And that resolved, presumably, the drag, but it was the only way you could sort out the drag because of these funny engines that had some puff coming out of the back of them. Just a little side.
But in fact, it's a bit more than a sideline because it has gone on ever since that the engine manufacturer will argue black is white before he wants to concede that maybe it's his engine isn't quite doing what it should do. Usually they will argue it's airframe drag and so on. And it is that type of work that gradually began to refine both test flying and performance evaluation and so on.
Can I go back a bit now, John, when you first joined Vickers as a test pilot under Mutt Summers, and he was going to teach you as you went along how to test fly an aircraft. Did you find it a formidable experience to be sitting in the right-hand seat with him in the left? And can you recall some incidents?
I shall never forget flying with Mutt Summers because I treat it as one of the greatest moments of my life because he was something different. As far as teaching me about test flying, 40 years later I would say I don't think I learned a lot from Mutt, frankly, that was of use to me in the future, and quite a lot of what he taught me I would rather forget because it was a different era. For example, I remember on a Valletta, I hadn't done much flying. It might have been with that spring tab, the rudder flutter we had. When Mutt landed an aeroplane like George Liddell, every landing was a forced landing. You always came back to base at the appropriate moment, the throttles were slapped shut. And if you touched the throttles again, it was completely impredictive. You know, you'd made a ball of it if you'd touched them. And violent side slips, such like. And I was 12 months away from Benson in the King's Flight, and the standards set there for flying were pretty bloody high. The categorization board was run by Wing Commander Scott, a New Zealander from the CAT board, and all of us had to have a VVIP categorization. And you more or less flew with a
bucket. What did that stand for?
Very, very important person, VVIP. I think it was the only outfit in the Air Force that had anything higher than VIP. And you flew with the proverbial pail of water in the back of the airplane, and if you spilt one drop, it just wasn't on. And it was an awful transition to see Mutt Summers coping with this, and I sat horrified, because I had never been in an airplane where 1 minute when you were landing there was the runway out of this side window, and a few seconds later Mutt was there, and over his head you could see the runway. And on one occasion he came down, he must have landed with 15 degrees of yaw. Straightened up. And I was so horrified that driving up to the office, I said to him, "Why do you land an aeroplane like that?" Now that was a brave thing to say, because Mutt was up here. "Why do you land with 15 degrees of yaw on it?" And he looked at me and said, "If I can't break it, the customer can't break it." Now, that's an interesting attitude when you're 25 and you've been with Vickers for a year, but when you think of it, it's not really a very realistic one. If I can't break it, the customer can't break it. But that was Mutt's approach to it. And any time we delivered in these days an aeroplane to Boscombe Down, be it a Valletta, a Varsity, or a Valiant, Mutt never delivered it. I used to take them down there when we handed it over to B Squadron for the official trials. And I could never really wonder why, because it was quite an event taking the prototype valiantly and handing it over to squadron leader so and so forth. The minister were going to do 30 hours flying. And the reason I think why Mutt wouldn't deliver them to Boscombe Down was there is no need. I think it's all right. I'm bypassing Boscombe Down. You take it to Boscombe and talk to them, but I'm not talking to them. I'm happy with it. Enough said. You see, it's the three generations again. And all the generations, when they get to the end of the time, become outdated very quickly in aviation. And I think Mutt was getting a little bit outdated post-war. He had done enough pre-war and during the war.
Didn't that show up, I believe, Jock, when you and Mutt came to fly the prototype Valiant for the first time? Because
yes.
Standing alongside the runway, everybody took a deep breath because there was a fairly severe wind drop and so on. And the Valiant was, I think it was our first aeroplane with fully powered controls.
Correct. It was. Irreversible power.
And this was therefore, that was the end of flying basically by the seat of your pants.
Good point.
I recall as a flight test engineer that we began to think we were at a watershed around that time.
Yeah.
And very shortly afterwards, Mutt retired, did he not?
Mutt did three trips in the Valiant and retired. And that was why, because powered controls, Mutt never, ever fully understood them. In the same way as I couldn't understand the most elementary space capsule at Cape Kennedy, it wouldn't mean a thing to me. Mutt, in the Valiant, fully power-operated irreversible power controls and artificial field. And the design office people had me in that aeroplane at Wisley quite soon after they had the whole thing installed, Ken Lawson.
Right.
And he had that field blower outside. He could blow up the field units to 180 knots, Jock. Right. Switch everything on. And that was you doing 180 knots. Do you want to feel it on the approach? Right. 125 knots. He would tweak it down, and that's how it's going to feel in the approach.
That was all done on the ground, was it?
On the ground, yeah. And there was no feedback because they were irreversible. If you hit turbulence, none of this business coming from the controls, because there was big hydraulic things being held there and they wouldn't tolerate it. I went into the aeroplane with Mutt on many occasions to get to know the cockpit with him, and he would switch on the power controls and do all this with nothing there, just the thing. It was set up for a basic 90 knots on a spring or something. Right. And never once in my memory did Mutt operate them at 180 knots or 280 knots or 380 knots to see what they were, because I think it must have been offered to him, but Mutt wouldn't accept it, because how the hell did they know how it was going to feel at 280 knots? The day would come when he could tell them how it felt at 280 knots, but there was no way they could tell him in the hangar. And that was Mutt getting towards, with the greatest of respect, getting towards the end of his career.
But he tragically died shortly after he retired, didn't he?
Yes, he 2 years after he retired, he went in for an operation, and it was about 10 days after the operation he had a heart attack and died in hospital. Mm. But as a flyer of an aeroplane, as a handler of an aeroplane, my word, he was different. And rather typical of the guy. Remember when the Spitfire came in to Wisley once?
Ah, yes, I do remember this.
I had flown it. I think it was the first Spitfire I'd ever flown, or the second, for fun. And as I walked across the little garden to his office, it was a hot day, I had my helmet off, and he said, "Get me that helmet, I'm going to fly that Spitfire." He flew the prototype Spitfire. And the buzz got around, and about all of us stood there and tried to watch the Spitfire fly. And they put some fuel in there, and up he came. Usual business, going far too fast, and taking off the grass. No run-up, no nothing, and he went whistling past the tower with the canopy open, the seat far too high, jaws were dealt with us. He selected the gear up, but he'd forgotten how to go through the gate, so the gear didn't come up. And he proceeded to do an aerobatic display, which impressed me, but it didn't impress Jaws Adele, because Jaws Adele, who was no mean Spitfire pilot, he had done many, many hours in them, said, "If you do that in that mark of Spitfire, the port oleo blocks the oil door, and his engine is going to overheat, and he'll lose the thing." And Mutt went up there and did the most violent and graceful aerobatics 5-10 minutes, and we're all sitting waiting to see the overheating. Never did. He came in, did one of his things, and popped the thing down, sweet as a nut. Hadn't flown one for umpteen years. Right. Came up and gave me the helmet, big grin in his face, and said, "Great, enjoyed that." Casual, and what a natural handler for an aeroplane. But a little bit forgetful of little details about making sure the gear's up before you do an aerobatic display.
There's a Mutt Summers tradition that Jock and his colleagues carried on for quite a few years, which was Mutt's idea of a first flight was, 4 or 5 minutes at the most. When one reads what happens in more recent years to other people's first flights,
I did 9 or 11 first flights, I'm not quite sure. Well, some of them as co-pilot, and some of them as captain. And the first one I did as captain was the Tay Viscount.
Yes.
The first one I did on my own. And I hadn't been to ETPS because of Mutt Summers, and I thought the only thing to do here is to do exactly what Mutt Summers did. And every time I was in the left-hand seat on the first flight, right up the VC-10 and the 111, I did it exactly the way Mutt Summers did it. And never once did I raise the gear. Always kept it down. John Cunningham raised the gear on the Trident and spent the whole of the first flight trying to get the thing down again. Mutt Summers said, "No, on the first flight, never mind the gear. Do that on the second flight when you've got 5 times as much fuel on board. Just do the essentials. Get a token flight." Mutt found out very little about an aeroplane in the first flight, but it was a get out of the way and get the publicity away, and it was a psychological thing.
Nevertheless, everybody knew that it would fly. Joe, I think that We've talked a fair bit about Wisley and the sort of technical contribution to the aeroplanes and so on, but surely Wisley, particularly the pilots, had a totally different contribution. That was to the marketing of the aeroplane, and you ventured forth to North America on trials and then became acquainted with different airlines and so on. I think I'm sure we all learned a great deal from that. One thing we were never quite allowed to forget was Jock Bryce had been there before to Canada during the war, if I'm right.
Yeah, I was, in 1943, was sent overseas, and it turned out to be Montreal, and had 18 months ferrying lease land bombers from Montreal to Prestwick. But it helped a little bit when Air Canada became, TCA became INSEAD, Trans-Canada Airlines became INSEAD in the Viscount. And going back to where you were 10 minutes ago, which I don't think you take, we do owe a lot to these various professionals, various professions in the engineering section of these major airlines. And I think George Edwards would be the first man to agree that the introduction of the Viscount into America came through Air Canada Americanizing.
One thing we were never quite allowed to forget was Jock Bryce had been there before to Canada during the war, if I'm right.
Yeah, I was, in 1943, was sent overseas, and it turned out to be Montreal, and had 18 months ferrying lease land bombers from Montreal to Prestwick. But it helped a little bit when Air Canada became TCA became INSEAD, Trans-Canada Airlines became INSEAD in the Viscount. And going back to where you were 10 minutes ago, which I don't think you take, we do owe a lot to these various professionals, various professions in the engineering section of these major airlines. And I think George Edwards would be the first man to agree that the introduction of the Viscount into America came through Air Canada Americanizing the aeroplane. Mm. For example, the tank-to-engine fuel system must be the classic example of why didn't we think of that? Because in the old Viscount, we used to do one tank to two engines.
That's right.
So a fuel failure and takeoff, and you lost two in one side. Air Canada, one tank to one engine. Now, that's good thinking.
Oh, there's one other bit of the technology I don't think was good thinking. Ron Baker and company couldn't quite see the point of fitting an autopilot on an aeroplane when you had two pilots there who should be capable of flying it.
Yep.
So we actually physically removed the autopilot, which was on the original BEA Viscounts. Later on, they saw common sense, I think, and fitted a Collins. But again, I found it quite interesting riding as a passenger on a delivery flight to see our crew having to hand fly the aeroplane. Do you recall that?
Oh, sure, yes. Since you brought up 1943. I used to hand fly a lot of aeroplanes across there, doing 130 knots. It was a long way. But you're talking about my favourite airline. Of the 50-odd airlines that bought Viscounts, I have the highest regard for Air Canada from an operational point of view. The way they went about, I know the maintenance was pretty good, but I'm no expert on that. But the way an Air Canada or TCA crew got onto the flight deck of a Viscount and moved it with 50 or 60 passengers from Montreal to Toronto was a thing of beauty to watch. Oh, I think George Lothian, he was the man behind this, but they all did the same thing. They were all nice fellows, most of them ex-RCAF, some of them pre-war, very senior pilots. Smart, absolutely proficient in the knowledge of the aeroplane and how to go about the business, good social guys. They would talk to passengers when necessary. They wouldn't talk to them when they had more important things to do. And an hour and 10 minutes later, the thing would taxi up to the ramp at Toronto. And I can remember thinking, how the hell did we get here? It's been all smooth silk. And that went for every crew I flew with, and I suppose I must have flown with 10 or 20 or 30 crews. They all did it the same way, and it was a joy to watch. Hats off to Air Canada.
They were the best. What you're really saying is that they lived the procedures, they lived the drills. It was part of their breathing, really.
Well, yes, but I think, I don't mean to, I'm not disagreeing in any way, but we did have, at that time, we had one or two outfits where Jock's training captains had a hell of a task getting the chief pilot through and getting the Viscount on his ticket, because we were going, in those instances, sometimes from DC-3s straight to a pretty what was a very sophisticated aeroplane at that time, the Viscount. I think the amazing thing was the way TCAs were able to absorb it, and we were seeing airline disciplines, both in the air and on the ground, to perfection, which...
That's right. And doing 50-odd all round the world, Monty, you found that the Canadians, from a national point of view, are bloody good operators of aeroplanes, and the Americans and the Australians, and you'll find the Indians, with the greatest of respect, not very good. And the bottom of our league was United Burma Airlines.
Yes.
Which I wouldn't go within a mile of a UBA park. Peter Marsh had, but it was never the same when he came back.
What are the major modifications that you have to do? I mean, presumably TCA burnt JP4 fuel, did they?
Yes.
Yes, they were
The airplane was cleared for either fuel.
Was it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So we had no... We had no modifications as such to do for that.
Well, wait a minute. It's a funny how your mind works, but I remember JP4 was cleared down to minus 55, but didn't the design office have to put in a fuel heater in the fuel line before the filter?
Quite right, yes, yes.
Because for the exceptional... If you had any moisture in the fuel, it could...
Right.
You're
quite right. But I mean, the problem that we got with Canadian winter operation, once you've got away from the trans-Canadian railway, if I can use that concept, a very narrow corridor running right coast to coast, if they started to go north in the winter, the aeroplanes, only a few hundred miles north, you had to essentially use whatever fuel was there, whatever fuel had been brought in during the summer season, and because of the military operations, it was, I think I'm right, primarily JP4.
I think that's the RCEF, which
yes.
JP4. And we were JP1 here.
JP1, yeah. Kerosene, yes.
When Air Canada, and the typical Air Canada way, before they signed the contract, they said, right, we've had some British aeroplanes before, I believe they had a thing called the Bristol Freighter.
Yes.
They said they come to a grinding halt in the winter time because you fellows don't know the first thing about cold weather operations. Oh, yes, we do. We have flown the Viscount at 35,000 feet and minus 15 at what's all right there. And they said, yeah, but this is a whole new thing. We want to take it out to Churchill and do some cold soaks. We want to see what happens when it's been outside for 24 hours. So... crowd of the design office fellas, flight test fellas, myself and Ron Baker, the chief engineering pilot of Air Canada, took the prototype out to Winnipeg, and it only got down to about minus 25, and they were looking for minus 45, so we flew it up to Churchill on Hudson's Bay. And that was rather interesting, talking about these various generations. Churchill must be 500 or 600 miles due north of Winnipeg, and it's February, and they're looking for minus 45. Ron Bacon, in a very quiet way, non-drinking, non-smoking Canadian, had a quiet word with me and said, Jock, your aeroplane isn't suitably equipped to fly up to Churchill. And I said, well, what's the trouble, thinking of some technical reason? He said, before I'm prepared to fly up to Churchill, and don't get me wrong, I want a few toboggans on here. I want a few rifles. I want X pounds of hardtack, 200 weights of Cadbury's chocolate, a 50-gallon drum of kerosene, snowshoes for every member of the crew, proper clothing and all the rest of it. And I wasn't quite sure whether it was a leg pull or not. He was an ex-bush pilot. And I said, Ron, now wait a minute, we've got a pressurized airplane, good radio communications, four reliable engines. Do you think it's necessary? And he said, Job, I wouldn't be coming with you tomorrow on this flight if I hadn't made it a strict rule not to fly without a gun, hardtack, chocolate and snowshoes. Okay, Ron. So I went down to the Hudson's Bay store with them with my Vickers letter of credit, which I can well remember was for $25,000, and I drew $2,500 in cash. We got an Air Canada truck, and he and I and some of the ground crew came down and loaded up these bloody sledges and such like, and loaded it onto the Viscount. And it was quite an interesting looking Viscount with this equipment. Joe Leach was the senior technical man.
That's right.
That thing. And we took it up to Churchill without any trouble. And they parked it out for 24 hours. And whenever the door was closed, they started a watch and said, in 24 hours, we'll open it. When 24 hours had elapsed, I can see Clayton Glenn and Joe Leach, the senior technical chap on board, with their clipboards. And they had an intriguing list of things to check. And I can always remember one of the things on the first page, whenever they got inside, they were going to check all the fire extinguishers, because they knew bloody well that Vickers fire extinguishers in there would be soppied inside, because we hadn't de-iced them, didn't know about de-icing them. And I was suitably dressed, whilst Joe went upstairs with Clayton Glenn, I think Ron Baker. And we came to a grinding halt. They couldn't open the door to get into there because the frame around it was whatever, I don't know, and the door was aluminium, and there was a differential expansion. And an hour later, we still had the big hot air blowers around there to try and get into our airplane, whereupon the whole Vickers contingent, about that size. And it proved Air Canada's point that we didn't really know too much about cold soaks. But once we sorted out some of these elementary things, I must say, mainly because of the engines, the aeroplane was a joy there, because Air Canada were quite intrigued to start up a Dart engine and open it straight up to 14,500 RPM. Rolls-Royce had no worries about it going straight up there. You could find it was a little bit laborious on the way up because of the congealed oil tended to slow it down. But compared to a piston engine technique, they were intrigued by it. And we very quickly got the aeroplane to work, and it was a very good winterized aeroplane in the end.
Sure. If you recall, we, having successfully got the aeroplane into TCA, and that was followed by, thanks to TCA, releasing three of their aeroplanes, we got into Capital Airlines, and then people began to get rather ambitious, and we sold to Northeast Airlines in the States, operating out of Boston. And then came the big crunch. An outfit called TWA, Times World Airlines. And I think we ought to really relate the efforts that went into trying to sell Howard Hughes, who then owned the airline, the aeroplane.
Monty, I thought you were my friend. This is a 6 weeks thing which was nonsensical when you look back on it, with the famous Howard Hughes, who, before he would discuss with George Air was at any length, purchasing 50 or 60 airplanes. Could you bring one across so that I can fly it and have a look at it? When would you like it there? How about tomorrow night? That sort of thing. I was detailed off for George Air was to take an airplane off the production line and take it across to the States for the benefit of this guy, Howard Hughes. Now, you refresh my memory, Monty. At that stage, were we building his own private executive?
Yes, here.
We were building an aeroplane for him here for his private use.
Yes.
For the Viking.
Yes.
Viking. Which nobody could touch except his people. And
right.
Each bit of skin had to be matched for colour, and nobody was allowed to move the aeroplane forward in the production line without his blessing. Do you still want me to continue with this? Because what day is today? It's Tuesday. This will take until about Friday.
I warn you.
Do you just want the guts of it?
Guts of
because
it.
What I know what guts Monty wants me to tell. This man, Howard Hughes, who I got to know reasonably well, and one of the most interesting guys I've ever met, was 95% genius with a capital G and 5% nuts.